from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September when a newspaper based in Arizona broke some news. The breaking story was the resignation of Kurt Volker, the U.S. Special Envoy for Ukraine, who left his position following reports that he collaborated with Ukraine and President Trump. The story gained international attention, and the 20-year-old journalist who reported it says he was just doing his job, covering the news for his campus newspaper. Andrew Howard, a junior at Arizona State University, is the managing editor of the school's paper, The State Press. His scoop on the story involved the university's connection to the McCain Institute, a think tank it runs in Washington. Volker is the institute's executive director. Howard confirmed Volker's resignation from his ambassador position with the university. While a student journalist breaking international news may be uncommon, news consumers across the country are experiencing a growing reliance on student newspapers. According to the New York Times, more than 2,000 professional newspapers have closed or merged in recent years, and with that, more than 1,300 communities have become news deserts, areas without local news coverage, essentially. And that's where student journalists are stepping in. Their work is informing the public about the workings of municipal government, local policies that have been enacted, and their reporting has even pushed powerful institutions into changing some of those policies. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, for example, the University of Michigan's newspaper, The Daily, covers a range of issues, including cuts to the county's mental health budget and issues related to a police oversight commission. The paper serves the 121,000 residents of Ann Arbor, which became the first city to lose its only daily newspaper. But student journalists are still students, after all. They got course loads, sometimes little journalistic training, and few professionals to guide them. So what does that mean for communities that now rely on student newspapers to fill the gap left by shuttered professional papers? Our panel discusses the impact of student newspapers, the future of daily newspapers, and the way we consume our news. Welcome in studio, a longtime print journalist before he became a teacher, Mike Johansson. How many years were you an ink-stained print journalist?
Well, I don't want to age myself too much, but I started as a cadet when I was 17, and 20-plus years.
20-plus years. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Welcome to Will Aiken, editor-in-chief of the Campus Times at the University of Rochester. Thanks for being here, Will.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
Also with us is Casey Matthews, print managing editor at Reporter at RIT. Casey, welcome.
Happy to be here.
And Kayla Kaiser is editor-in-chief of Reporter at RIT. Welcome to you, Kayla. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
So, Mike, before we kind of get the student perspective here, because we're going to go in a lot of different directions here, but I have to admit the New York Times story shook me, because we hear about newspapers cutting back, cutting staff. Unfortunately, we've been hearing about that in the Democrat and Chronicle for years. We've even heard some communities going all digital. But the idea that entire communities now could have no print journalism or just student newspapers, it puts a lot of pressure on students, particularly when, you know, like we mentioned, they've got a lot to balance in their lives. How do you feel about this trend?
Well, I mean, I thank God for student journalists in some places.
Yeah, in
absolutely.
Many ways. I don't mean to denigrate.
No, not at all. But the one thing I do think is interesting is that the newspapers, you know, traditionally have been like the core of a community. They're sort of a pillar of a community. And the fact that so many of them over the years have become part of these corporate shareholder beholden companies has actually been pretty bad for journalism, because, you know, you've got to keep making money, or at least not losing so much money. Therefore, you've got to cut, and usually that means cutting the news. But I think one of the quotes, and I'm sort of thinking about the show that came back to me this morning, was that we all pay for journalism in one way or another. You either pay for it up front and know what's going on, or you pay for it in consequences when you don't know what's going on. So one way or another, we're all paying for journalism.
Yeah, and, you know, so obviously, full disclosure, our listeners know by now that WXXI has a partnership with City Newspaper. Hmm. And City Newspaper may in some ways, to the extent that we're looking at competition, I guess, benefit from the struggles of the Democrat and Chronicle. But I've been a full-throated supporter of the Democrat and Chronicle on this program. I believe in print journalism. I think it is vital. I think the idea of having an entire community's council meetings, school board meetings, everything sort of go uncovered by professional journalists is a truly troubling trend here. But I don't know a model that's going to fix it. We'll talk about that this hour. Do you? I mean, we'll talk about what's happening in Salt Lake, where they're going to a nonprofit model. Maybe that?
Right. Oh, absolutely. If you go nonprofit, then immediately you can potentially lower your advertising rates, increase your income that way, maybe lower the cost of the product itself. Yeah, sure.
All right. So I want to talk to the students about what it is they're doing at their on their campuses with these papers, because, again, every publication has sort of a different goal. So Kayla Kaiser, editor-in-chief of Reporter at RIT, what's the mission of Reporter?
So our goal essentially is to keep our student body informed about what's going on campus, as well as give our students a chance to practice journalism. We have a range of staff members with writers, videographers, photographers, artists, designers. So we really have, you know, an all-encompassing group of people working on these magazines, and we produce online articles as well as monthly print magazines. So we really get to have our hand in both sides of it.
You know, journalists at WXXI, at City, at the Democrat and Chronicle, they're trying to break news. They're trying to report news that matters to communities and break stories. Is that, would you say it's a different mission? Is that part of the mission at Reporter at RIT?
I think it's a little bit of both. Our main goal is not necessarily to break news, more so to just keep on top of what RIT is doing, what's happening in the Rochester community, and hold our school and ourselves accountable. We don't strive to, you know, be the first people to report on an issue, because we just frankly don't have the bandwidth to do that. We're students, as you mentioned earlier. We have class loads, we have other responsibilities, and so we typically take a little bit longer on our articles, but we always want to make sure we're putting out the best and most factual information.
Does it concern you seeing, as the New York Times reported, a growing list of American communities in which all you've got are student journalists?
Yeah, I think so, especially because, again, we are students. We can't focus all of our attention to breaking the news that's happening in our community. We can do our best, but we have our other priorities as well.
Mm-hmm. Does that put too much pressure on students? I mean, do you feel any sense of pressure at all in the work you're doing? Or do you think, look, sort of we're in our silo, we're doing what we do, we're not paying attention to what's happening outside?
Well, I think we have to be paying attention, because it does shape how we work as a newspaper, or I guess in our case, we're a magazine. Yeah. More so than a newspaper. We take what we're doing seriously, and we want to try and focus more on what's going on outside as well. So we don't just want to ignore the fact that there aren't, or that newspapers are dying, but we can't, I don't think that we can solely be responsible for bringing it back.
Sure. Well, you know, Casey Matthews, newspapers are dying because they say your generation's killing them. I mean, are you the one holding the knife here?
Just maybe. But I think a big issue is that we're looking for more instant gratification, and that follows in with news stories as well. We're looking for more up-to-date information, and by the time newspapers hit print, it's already 20 hours, 24 hours old.
I mean, my God, it's just hours old. No, but I'm sort of poking fun, but I'm listening. I hear you. So the immediacy matters.
Mm-hmm. You look on New York Times, you look on Washington Post, they're posting stories, breaking news that happened an hour ago, 6 hours ago. And by the time newspapers come around, it's already old news, and you have a lot of clutter around it that's distracting, and it just isn't as efficient, I guess, as our generation is sort of wanting news to be.
We're going to talk about a little bit more about that this hour and what we do about that. But when it comes to what you do at Reporter, how do you see the role of Reporter?
I see Reporter as an information source, and also as a way to, like Kayla said, hold administration and hold faculty, staff members, and everything like that accountable, as well as holding students accountable. We have student government that we hugely support as students, but on the other side of that, student government isn't perfect either, and we have to hold them accountable as well.
Okay. Will Aiken, editor-in-chief of the Campus Times of the University of Rochester. What's the mission of the Campus Times?
Our goal, similarly to Reporter, we kind of have two main goals that you can kind of put into different categories. So we have our goal of reporting, which is to tell stories that need to be told, to hold people accountable, to educate. And I shouldn't have used the word educate there, because that's actually the other category, which is to educate, to teach people how to write news, how to write journalism, how to write a proper opinions piece, what the editorial process looks like. And those are kind of our two missions, and my job is basically to balance both of those.
Let me go ahead and read from the New York Times story, and I'm curious to get your view, Will, about, you know, whether this kind of scenario of stories that are reported by students, student journalists, becomes major news in a community, major news not just on a campus, but in a city, in a region, or even internationally. Let me just read some of the examples. A high school newspaper in Pittsburgh, Kansas, forced the resignation of a principal after discovering discrepancies in her resume. After writing an article about a school employee's unprofessional conduct charges, high school editors in Burlington, Vermont, won a censorship battle against their principal. And we talked about what happened with Ukraine and the State Department, the paper in Arizona. Then in Ann Arbor, despite little training and no university journalism program at all, the staff of the Michigan Daily has embraced its role. Last year, in the wake of the Me Too movement, it published a lengthy investigation that detailed sexual misconduct allegations against a professor, leading to his early retirement. In 2014, the paper published a major scoop about a sexual assault that the university concealed to protect a football player. And on the first day of classes this semester, the Daily reported that the university had quietly stopped offering free testing for sexually transmitted diseases, prompting protests that forced the school's administration to reinstate that program. So those are some stories that the Times is flagging as saying these would be major stories no matter who is reporting them. It just turns out in these communities all you have are student journalists. Could you envision those kind of scenarios in Rochester?
Well, to a degree, it's happened.
I think that's a fair point, right?
It was in my first year at the University of Rochester, was kind of at the peak of a scandal involving a professor, T. Florian Jaeger, and misconduct allegations against him. And that was a huge story. It led to the resignation of the president at the time. There was widespread outrage on campus. Two of the people who had brought this to light ended up in Time magazine. So, yeah, I mean, that was a national story, and that was something that we worked very hard to cover. When I say we, I don't mean I myself was not involved at
sure,
the time.
Sure, no, I understand.
But, yeah, so it's really already happening. It's not as much something I could envision as much as something that is a reality.
Mm-hmm. Does the reality of shrinking professional journalism newsrooms put undue pressure on students in generally, and have you felt that at all?
While it might on a level, on a consumer level, in terms of we might have more people looking at us for news that they would otherwise in a different world get from local papers or things like that, I've never really heard it discussed amongst ourselves or in the office. More often than not, what we're talking about is our obligation to the campus community, because ultimately that is what our goal is to serve the campus community. You know, when we can, we like to make our audience as broad as possible. But because we are a campus paper, we are ultimately reporting more often than not on campus issues. So usually that's how we're framing the discussion.
All right. So I'm going to go to Mike Johansson last on this one, because I want to let the students go first, and then we're going to compare and contrast. Not to say, well, there's a generation gap. Well, I want to know how you consume your news. And in an average day, how do you get your news, Will?
I have the New York Times app on my phone. I'll get notifications from the New York Times. I also follow a lot of journalists that I like on Twitter, so I'll be finding articles that way. But usually I try to read a couple of full articles a day, beginning to end. I won't just be looking at headlines. I won't just be looking at notifications. And that's kind of the way I stay up to date and make sure that I'm always kind of learning new things and learning new writing styles and things, is by making sure that I read things from beginning to end, which I think is something that has been getting lost a little bit.
Okay, fair enough. Let's ask Casey and Kayla about that. Casey, what's your daily routine?
Pretty similar, actually. I, rather than the New York Times app, I have just a general news app on my phone that draws articles from a bunch of different sources that are trending and read through those. And I also use Facebook, as much as it sort of has a negative connotation to it now, reading Facebook articles and things like that, but then also following up with those and doing further investigation into the real, like, grunt work of the issue at hand.
Okay. Kayla?
There's an app, and more specifically a company called The Skim, and they have what's called the Daily Skim. So you can get emails, or it's an app where they will send you basically your morning news brief. So it's a few short paragraphs about the main things that have been going on, and you can click on their links to read the full articles. But it's a nice way of taking a lot of news and shrinking it down to something that's really digestible, which is kind of what our generation looks for right now.
Okay. Are you listening to podcasts?
Not very much, no.
Okay.
Not really.
No. Will?
I am. Especially in the morning, I'll often switch on a news podcast or something like that. And I find it really, it's just part of my routine at this point. But it's really helpful just in terms of getting what's happening.
So, Mike Johansson, after you make your morning phone calls on your rotary phone and you do all those things, what is your routine?
Hand crank my car.
What's your routine?
Well, I get up. I usually check email first. And one of my emails I get every morning is the overnight email from the New York Times, mm-hmm. what we're reporting today, which is it's sort of like the Daily Skim, a really nice little digestive news. I happen to have a subscription to the New York Times, so that's also part of the thing. I have a couple of Twitter lists that I go to first thing in the morning. I have one just called Journalists, just to see what they're sharing. I have an NZ New Zealand on Twitter, what's happening in New Zealand. That's how I learned about the volcano, for example, the other day. At like 4:30 in the morning when I was up. So I do that. If I've got some extra time before I go to the gym, I'll actually take the A section of the New York Times and read a couple of stories. While I'm at the gym, I'm on usual local TV stations news, flipping between that and CNN and ESPN. When I'm driving, I'm on XXI, listening to the radio and the news, 1370 on my way in. Same when I'm driving home. If I have time on the lunch break, I'm listening to this show or checking the Google News. So that's pretty much my routine. I sort of seem to sort of not do much of that late in the day. I think my attention is probably on other things.
But. Yeah, no, I take the point. Students, how many of you own and use a car? Car, yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. 2 out of 3, yes. When you're in your car, are you listening to anything in regards to news programming? And you don't have to say yes, even though you're sitting here in WXXI Studios.
I don't. Sometimes I'll have on just like a music radio station, and there will be like quick little clips of the news, but...
All right, I'm dying inside a little bit. Go ahead.
It's pretty similar here. I don't typically do news or anything like that. I'll listen to a few more informative podcasts, mm-hmm. but even those aren't really like breaking news or anything.
Let me ask the three students who are here. Do you watch any local commercial television news?
No.
I do not, no.
Do you know anyone your age who does?
No.
No.
I know a couple, but not many.
Okay. Do you know anyone who pays for a subscription to the Democrat and Chronicle?
No.
No.
I might know a few people whose families do and get it that way, but no one who personally does.
Okay. Well, we've heard enough this hour. There's going to be a half an hour of dead air for the rest of the hour here because we're all doomed. No, so let me read from NPR. NPR did a story last month about the Salt Lake Tribune becoming the first legacy newspaper to change to a nonprofit structure. And I'll just read a little bit from there. The Tribune becoming the first legacy newspaper in the country to transform itself into a nonprofit organization. Instead of selling the paper for scrap metal, its owner is giving up control. The paper will still rely on subscribers and advertising, but now it can also receive tax-deductible cash donations, and it's creating an endowment to help run the paper in perpetuity. Jennifer Napier Pierce is the Tribune's editor-in-chief, and she says the old business model doesn't work anymore. It is entirely broken. So the Tribune is hoping the new model will open the door to donations from both regular folks and philanthropists who want to lift up public service journalism. Is that the future, Mike Johansson?
Yeah, and in fact, I've been saying this for a few years now. I think communities would be really smart to find a few well-to-do folks who would back a not-for-profit entity to either start or take over the local newspaper. And I think also the local newspapers probably need to be smarter about how they deliver the news. Printing something 7 days a week is a huge waste of resources. I know that's what advertisers want, but if I had to bet, I would say that most of those advertisers are over 50 and they won't be around forever. And so, you know, I think getting smarter about the way you deliver the news, tailoring it to different audiences. I mean, this is a huge problem. I mean, as the students all point out, you know, they obviously don't feel that the news is presented in a way that's useful to them. So delivering it in different ways, maybe doing a weekly digest. This is something that I'm a big fan of a thing called The Week, which is just a little glossy news magazine that comes out once a week. And no matter how much I follow the news, I find, you know, a dozen or so things in that every week that I missed somehow during the week. So you could have a community where you've got a very vibrant news organization. It's a not-for-profit. It's providing news in multiple ways, email, online, alerts, however you want to do it, maybe partnering with a TV and radio station, not hint, hint, XXI, but puts out a weekly digest, which literally shows up in your mailbox on a Saturday when you have the weekend to look at it.
Well, and Mike, as you know, for a long time, newsrooms had this assumption about your co-panelists, which was that, well, you're all around 20 years old. You know, in 10 years, they'll be getting married, starting families. Then they will, you know, they'll buy a house, they'll get a newspaper subscription, they'll watch the nightly news, they'll move into that sort of post-school adult life. I don't think those assumptions work anymore. I think if you have any sort of assumption that, well, they're 20, you know, we are adopting their habits more than they are adopting ours, is what I see.
Absolutely. And I would say of the people I know in their 30s and 40s, the percentage of those people who pay for news is literally nowhere near what it was 20 years ago.
Absolutely. So you can't just point the finger now and say, well, you know, this is a sample of 20s, people who are 20 years old, not 30 or 40. This is happening. We're following the trend of technology, and we're becoming more like them than they are like your old generation.
Yeah. And can I just add here, too, that as much as I respect the people who are still doing very good journalism for newspapers everywhere, the one thing that irritates me to no end, and maybe a caller will say these exact words, is, but you've got to support journalism. It's a cornerstone of democracy. You've got to pay for it, otherwise it'll go away.
Well, and I say that.
Right. But that's, to me, that's like telling your kid, eat your peas, they're good for you. Right? I mean, the journalism has to be good, it has to be relevant. But why is me paying a corporation that's paying shareholders and has a profit motive, why is that the only way to do it?
So you agree it's broken, like Jennifer Napier-Pierce said from Salt Lake.
Absolutely.
That model is broken. It's not sustainable. It will soon be dead.
Major newspapers, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, they're going to stick around. They can afford to. And notice that those are not necessarily shareholder owned papers either.
Yeah, no, I take that point. I mean, the biggest of the big are doing just fine, especially in the Trump era, but the vast majority of others don't enjoy that success. And before I turn back to the students to kind of help guide this conversation, I want to hit one other point that you're raising here. I have some concern that the one part of the concern I have with a not-profit model is this idea that you can rely on philanthropists, big donors, you know, each major market or each market that will have this kind of a thing will have someone who will step up. Well, we've got lots of philanthropists in this country, and we still have a lot of poverty, and we have a lot of people who can't afford higher education. We have a lot of people who struggle to find the kind of income to provide a basic life. And so for all of the work that philanthropists do in every community, they are not fixing these structural problems. I wouldn't want to just rely on that, I don't think.
And that's not what I meant to suggest at all. What I meant to suggest, and if there are well-to-do people in the Rochester community who'd like to talk to me about this, I could talk your ear off over this topic forever. Buy me a beer. I'm cheap. what I meant was having five or six well-to-do people just to provide the underwriting, the insurance, if you like, that the not-for-profit will not fail. In other words, they're there and they're a safety net. It's still run as a business because, for example, if you were to say that the Gannett Company were willing to give up the Democrat and Chronicle to a not-for-profit to run it here, I'm pretty sure they would only give it up on the basis that part of the deal would be part of the debt that the Democrat and Chronicle owes as part of the corporation. So you'd be taking on debt right from the outset. So you really need someone to, no bank's going to say, sure, we'll just do that. You need some people to underwrite that. But you could run it as a business, and you would run it in the black. You would have to run it in the black. Part of the other piece of this model is you don't necessarily have full-time reporters. You don't go back to a 200-person newsroom like the Democrat and Chronicle used to have. You can't. You have a core pool of editors, maybe a core few reporters, but you rely a lot more on professional stringers, which is sort of the part of journalism that people seem to have forgotten. I mean, even when I first started right out of graduate school here in Rochester, the DNC still had, I think we had about six stringers out in the region who were high school teachers or other things, but at night they covered county meetings or they covered politics or they covered the latest breaking story in those areas. I think that's definitely a model that's worth bringing back.
After our only break of the hour, we're going to ask the students to do a couple of things. First of all, we're going to ask them to become advisors for existing newsrooms and the professional space. And frankly, we probably should have young journalists in every newsroom basically helping people understand what are the consumption habits? And when it comes to immediacy, how do you fill that need in a different way? What would make someone consume your product if they're not already doing it? and I know they can't speak for everyone who's 19 or 20 or 21 or whatever, but I think that this, their work as journalists, as students who are really sort of plugged in, will help us there. And I also am very curious to know about what kinds of stories do matter. We have seen a number of Me Too stories broken on campuses. And, you know, as Will mentioned, the University of Rochester had its own, frankly, its own scandal that became national news. And so the question is, which kinds of students matter the most to the students who are with us here in studio? We're talking to Mike Johansson, is the former print journalist who's been teaching for a number of years now, but spent about 20 years in professional newsrooms. And with us here in studio, Will Aiken, editor-in-chief of the Campus Times of the University of Rochester. Casey Matthews is a print managing editor at Reporter at RIT, and their editor-in-chief is Kayla Kaiser. And we're talking about not just this New York Times story, which finds that a growing list of American communities don't have newspapers at all, unless it's a student newspaper. That puts a lot of pressure on them. But the future of consumption habits. Are we going to have the kind of journalism that our communities need around the country? We continue the discussion next. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Listeners, if you want to call the program, we'll even accept calls on a rotary phone. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can find us on our different platforms as well. You can follow us on Twitter, at Evan Dawson, or MMAC Media on most days when producer Megan Mack is here. She's taking her first day off in like 6 months today. So if you, before we get some of your phone calls, students, if you're advising in a professional newsroom and they say, help us, we want to be here, we want your generation to consume our product, we want to be accessible, we want to be meeting your needs, we have to do our jobs, but what needs to change? Kayla, what's the first piece of advice?
I think the main thing I would say is that right now, the way that we do journalism obviously is not too successful anymore. And what's really important is that this generation, people who are currently in college and coming out of college soon, we are the generation of journalists who are going to be shaping how the future of news is. So I think it's really important to get us in the newsroom, whether it's for internships, volunteer experiences, or just to come and, you know, listen in, see how the newsroom works, and figure and get our opinions, you know, while you're doing your job, while you're in office, while you're sitting and writing your article, ask us what we think. You know, sometimes experience, you know, being in the industry for 30 years, that's great. But because times have changed, it's important to get those fresh perspectives.
I think that's phenomenal counsel. I will briefly share, and it wasn't in this building at all. It was in a past life career of mine. Interns would come in and they would be told to just fill envelopes, you know, do grunt work. It was an absolute waste when we could have been taking the perspective of, are you consuming this kind of product? And if not, why not? That's really, really good stuff. What do you think, Casey?
I'd have to agree. Another thing, too, is just the method of writing and the sort of format that takes. A big thing that, for better or worse, our generation does is to have sort of a shorter attention span and be more easily distracted by things. So shortening those articles down to what you need to know, sort of like Mike was saying with The Week, to where it does give you an overview of stories and things like that. And then maybe having extra info at the bottom or another fuller article that you could click to for more information to get the full extent of it. So that way you're still getting everything you need to know on the subject while also still having access to the more in-depth niche situational things.
Okay, Will?
I think a big thing that that journalists and journalistic organizations should be thinking about is, and this sounds very simple and obvious, but how things look on your phone. Because that's how most people are looking at journalism now. That's how most people are consuming it. And I mean, I'm just thinking about, so I usually do not read the Washington Post. It's not a paper that I read that often. I read City newspaper. I read the New York Times. I sometimes read Vox. I do not read the Washington Post. But when they put out those Snapchat stories where they'll have like a full, you know, over 1,000-word article with a lot of images, and they'll put it on a Snapchat story, I will read the whole article from beginning to end, just swiping through, just scrolling through. So I do think there is definitely an answer through social media, not even necessarily changing the writing style. I think visual format has a lot to do with it, because I think that's a lot of what's changed.
I think that's also very wise. I mean, when you talk about Snapchat, that's some of what some of our listeners who aren't really on the social scene might say, well, how are you reading on Snapchat? You want to just describe for people who've never consumed in that way?
Sure. What it is, I'm not sure if it's called a story or what the name of it exactly is, but what it is you basically click on it as if it were a Snapchat story. And it basically, what it is it's just a series of pictures. And there will be text kind of in the bottom half overlaid onto the picture. And as you scroll through, kind of the words will fade into different words. And if you scroll some more, it'll change to a different picture. And eventually you're kind of, it's really, you're just reading a news article, but it's just, it comes across the screen in a different way other than, aside from like, you know, when you're just scrolling through an article on a regular news website, it has a more kind of, there's a different kind of flow to the way the images change. Or certain words will be highlighted or certain phrases. So the style is different. It's a little hard to describe as I've made clear, but yeah.
No, okay, sure. Your colleagues at RIT, you like that approach?
I'm not really on Snapchat. I don't have it on my phone. It's not my platform of choice, so I personally can't speak to that. But I will say when it comes to if I go on Instagram, I'll scroll through what people have posted, but when I click on the stories, I like that I can just quickly click through and see what's happening. And so I think even utilizing photojournalism a little bit more is one way you could help with that attention span.
I like that. Casey, what do you think?
We are a generation that loves good visuals. So being able to click through, being able to see everything in a, I guess, more easily digestible portion, one more at a time, it would definitely help keep our attention spans focused on the article itself and on the news while also still feeding us all the information we need.
That's really good. WXXI recently hired one of the great photojournalists in the city, Max Schulte. And Max, man, they are speaking your language. You know, photojournalism, combine it with text, create these different formats. Vox does a good amount of that too. They do it some with video, but with text overlaid, sometimes with music. Really interesting presentation. Makes sense to you, Mike Johansson? What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the Washington Post Snapchat, well, it was an experiment. Now it's a real thing. I've been watching it pretty closely, and I think that absolutely gets to that whole point of giving people news where they want to consume it. That absolutely is the way to go.
Jane in Rochester wants to join the conversation. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Evan. I read City News, which I very much like. It hits the local issues that no matter how controversial, it seems like they'll go there. And the politics, and they talk about small business, which I appreciate. And also, I listen to free radio, especially Amy Goodman. And when Jeff Smith is subbing for Tom Hartman, I listen to that. And, of course, WXXI. And, of course, WXXI is at the top of the list. But what I wonder about with the Democrat and Chronicle, when I first came here, you know, I didn't have a newspaper, and I got my paper from the newsstand. And that, to me, is such an excellent way to advertise. You read a few issues, and you think, I like what I read. I believe I'll subscribe. And that's what happened. I did for years and years. Subscribe to it. I quit because I couldn't get my paper delivered in the morning, and especially on the weekends, weekend after weekend, and I would call and call, we'll get you a paper right out, and the paper never came, so they had a second chance to get it to me. And this went on for over a year, and I just had it. But before that happened, I had had a newspaper delivery person for many years. And he not only delivered it on time, it was almost, I knew almost the hour that it would come. You know, he was so regular and dependable. So I'm wondering about the advertising. It seems like I just rarely see a newsstand where compared to when I first came here, I saw it everywhere. And to me, that is the best sort of advertising you can have. It lures people in to grab a paper and decide for themselves whether it's worth subscribing to. And I don't know why I don't see that. But I really was interested in, what's his name, David Andretti, when I read a few of his
articles.
Yeah,
Dave Andretti, yeah.
Yeah, Andretti. And that really turned me on.
Well,
I think he's really good.
Well, Jane, thank you. And we appreciate the support and the endorsement of City's moves there. Mike, anything you want to add there?
Well, the reason, Jane, that you don't see the newspaper boxes out there anymore, or not so many of them, is that people were just not using them. You can still see the newspaper out on racks in places like Wegmans and Tops and so forth, but people were just not picking up newspapers out of a newspaper box. They're expensive to maintain. They're prone to freezing up and all kinds of other issues. They get trashed by snow plows and so forth. So I'm pretty sure that they're very hard to find now because people are just not using them.
I got a flood of email. You guys use email, don't you? Good.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I have a ton to read here.
Although that may be atypical among college students.
Yeah, I don't know. Everyone is just texting these days, and no one is leaving voicemails. We did learn that recently. When's the last time someone left you a voicemail, and did you think, why did you leave me a voicemail? Is that true? Does that happen? Yes?
My grandmother still leaves me voicemails.
Well, that's sweet, though. Yeah. That's different. That's treasured. But if it's like one of your peers, if someone leaves you a voicemail, do you assume it's an emergency?
Typically.
Okay, see. Look at how everything's changing. Chris says, I like the idea of papers being nonprofit, but I'm concerned that if the benefactor is a family like the Mercers or the Kochs or Sinclair Media, what sort of news we'll be getting? Mike, I think this is a fair concern here. If we're relying on philanthropists to sort of guarantee the survival of print outlets, is there going to be pressure to conform the news to please that particular benefactor's point of view?
Well, I think if you're a smart community group and you're a not-for-profit, you probably don't accept the backing of one person with a particularly strong point of view. You probably try and have a mix of a half a dozen to a dozen people who have a wide variety of political views. I mean, I understand that concern, but I don't know that you'd be smart to have a not-for-profit backed by a single strong-viewed individual.
Okay, that's fair enough. And I will also say this. Here at WXXI, we have a very strong community of membership. And we hope that it's growing every day. Yes, we have three different short weeks a year where we do pledge drives and membership campaigns, but you can become a member anytime you want, and we would love for you to do that. Having said that, yes, there's also underwriters, and there are some supporters who write bigger checks than others. People might know Tom Golisano does. First time I was hosting this program and Tom Golisano came in, I remember when we were done with the hour, and there were some people in the building who went, whoa. I said, why whoa? And they said, well, you went at him pretty hard. And I said, yeah. You know, my part of the building is separate from that part of the building. And Tom knows that. Here's the thing that I would say about Tom Golisano. This is not me kissing up to a big donor. He gets in the studio and he's always like, you know, it's no holds barred. You know, there's no, just go wherever you want. Every time. I would not do it otherwise. But I think the emailer's question is a fair one. If this becomes a model, is there influence? And I think that question is fair. Chris, thank you for that.
Well, it's something to be alert for sure.
And by the way, that's the second email on this. What happens if philanthropists, outrights are pushing an agenda or influencing the reporting? So I think that those are fair concerns to raise here. I've got a question from Janice who says, for your student guests, do any of them plan to go into journalism after graduating, first of all? Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think so.
Not for me.
Okay. Two out of three say yes. Okay. And if so, what do those jobs look like? What do you want to do?
I think, you know, the fact that that print journalism has been starting to struggle or has been continuing to struggle does not mean that journalism as a concept or as a function is dying. I still think there's plenty of opportunities in podcasting and video, even in written news, which I think a lot of people think is on the way out. I think there is definitely still a place for it. People are still willing to read. I know I certainly am. And I think even if you look at newer sites that people kind of see as being, a lot of people will look at them as not wholly legitimate or not wholly journalistic. Places like BuzzFeed, even there you see some really good long-form writing.
Okay, so maybe a place like that, that's where your future lies.
Yeah, it's still quite open-ended, but yeah.
Okay. Kayla?
So I'm not a big fan of like news in the traditional sense. I don't want to go and break news. I don't want to be out on the field trying to get the best story first. I like more long form pieces. And over the summer, I had an internship where I wrote health and medical related articles and infographics. And it was a more specialized field. So I think something where I'm focusing in on one overarching topic, so health or technology or business, and focusing in on that is where I'd want to go.
Does, and this is a speak for your generation kind of question, does your generation view it as potentially troubling that a lot of people now don't want to pay for content, in particular journalism, and what that means. Is that a problem, Kayla?
That we don't want to pay for content? I think it's more where it's hard to get a job when you first get out of college, from what I've been told. And so when we're just trying to get by at first, that might be one of the last things we're thinking about paying for.
I think that's a fair point. Casey, what do you think?
I think an issue, too, would be looking into, I guess, what priorities we do have and trying to sort through that. We, again, going back to the immediacy situation, we can get sort of news stories and things like that for free to draw us in. But making us subscribe is one thing that I think a lot of news organizations are struggling with, trying to keep readers rather than just like attract them for that first couple of articles.
Okay. Will?
Yeah, I think that, yeah, I'm not sure. It's hard for me to say, but I think, I'm sorry, would you mind repeating the question?
Well, I think for me, the question is probably a little unfairly posed to just the students, because we're all engaged now in technological platforms where we can get a lot of what we want for free. Mm-hmm. But it's, in particular, it's always viewed as, well, the young generation doesn't want to pay for anything.
I think conversationally, when people my own age, when we're talking about this, they'll usually kind of frame it that way. Like, it's a problem that people don't want to pay. At the same time, I think very few people, when it comes down to it, are willing to pay, just because young people are usually in school. They usually have to be very selective about what they're paying for. And if something can be offered for free and they can get it for free, it's really hard to convince someone to pay for that.
Aching inequality doesn't help the future of journalism, Mike.
Right. So what and this is the question for the three students, if I might ask a question. What if you had one app that would cost you $5 a month, and that app would offer you coupons every single day that would save you anywhere from $20 to $50 a day, right out of the gate, would offer you news in any way, shape, or form that you wanted it. You could tailor it to what your interests were, delivery, short, long, whatever. You could get good photojournalism, and you could actually get links to more portals of information than you could possibly handle. Everything from like restaurant reviews and everything else in town. Would you pay $5 a month for that?
I like to think that I would.
It's pretty easy to say that we would, but looking into, I guess, the initial purchase, that's something that a lot of people, I think, have a hard time getting over that hurdle.
Mm-hmm. Even if it was offering you $10 to $20 of value every single day.
Unfortunately. Okay. I would like to think I would, but...
Yeah. Kayla?
I think I would have to know if this app was valid or not, because there's a lot of commercials on TV. It's like, take this survey, make $10. But is it actually, you know, take the survey, make $10? What's the catch?
Yeah, well, the model for this is your weekly newspaper, because that's what it used to be, $5 a week. It had coupons in it that would save you anywhere from $200 to $400 a week. It had all the information you needed. And so really, that's, I mean, that model, it could be there, for example, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think Casey's being the most honest here, saying, sounds like we would, but how many of us would actually do? You want to add to that, Will?
Yeah, I just, one thing that I think is interesting is you hear a lot of people talking about how important it is to get news from different sources. And so it's, I think, hard for a lot of younger people to commit to one source like that, to say, I'm going to pay for this one source and I'm going to get everything from there, because I think of a lot of the discussions about biased journalism, you know, the whole fake news narrative. And I think because of that, people have been trying to take from different sources and pull from different sources when they're getting their information a lot. And I think because of that, it becomes harder for younger people to commit to a single source financially.
Sure, I get that. But what if this was also an aggregator that pulled in stuff from other places for you?
That would be very attractive to me.
Okay. Mike, good luck with that model. before we close here, I got a couple of emails, and I'll read. Mike writes to us about a question for student journalists about the recent story out of the Daily Northwestern. How much did you follow that? Yeah, you're all familiar? Okay. So just to kind of summarize for listeners who didn't follow that, Jeff Sessions was visiting, and there were pressure by students. You know, there were protests about a former Trump cabinet member coming. The Daily Northwestern covered it. Some of their reporting, as I understand it, identified some students who were protesting, and in some cases, they called to follow up to ask questions about students who were there. Students who received calls from journalists felt that that was a violation of their privacy when you know, I mean, for me as a I'm 40. That to me is journalism, when you call someone to follow up and ask questions. But the Daily Northwestern decided to publicly apologize to students who were angry with their methods, who felt that they had had their privacy violated. And it sort of sparked this online debate about whether the student journalists were sort of capitulating to activists as opposed to just standing up saying, hey, we're doing our jobs here. I think a lot of this gets overblown. I think we can wring our hands sometimes about this stuff. And but let me just ask the students, and Will, I'll start with you. What did you make of that debate about Northwestern?
Well, first of all, there was a detail that you left out there that I think is pretty important to include, which is the photo aspect, that there were photos of students, of protesters there, and a lot of students felt that those photos being online specifically was a violation of their privacy.
But they were in a public space, right?
Yes, but one of the controversial things that Northwestern did was take down at least one of the photos.
Right, despite them being taken in public spaces.
Yes.
Yeah.
In terms of what I make of this, one aspect is, well, Northwest, that university does not, as I understand it, does not protect student protesters, meaning there is room for retaliation academically or however, mm-hmm. From the university to students who protest or students who disrupt. So with that in mind, the paper does definitely have an obligation to protect students. So there is the question, so there's that question. But then there's the question of, once you publish something, if there's nothing inherently wrong with the reporting, if it was in a public space, is it right to take it down? And I think unless there is a truly endangering element, and I think there's a discussion to be had there, it doesn't sound like, and I haven't seen the picture, it doesn't sound like that was the right decision to make. I also don't think it was the right decision to apologize for calling for comment. As I understand it, the phone numbers were on a student directory,
yep.
So they were accessible to anyone. So if anything, the issue should be with the administration for putting the numbers there.
However, can we at least say that the student journalists who made these decisions were trying to do, they were trying to show empathy?
Absolutely.
And there's going to be mistakes made.
Absolutely. And I think the kind of public finger wagging on
the pylon,
it has been really, it's been overblown and kind of vitriolic. And there was someone, I can't remember who wrote this, it was another student journalist wrote that it could have been a teachable moment, and it's really become something bigger and worse than that.
Yeah, it's sort of a point-scoring moment, unfortunately. Kayla, what did you make of it?
I think my main takeaway is that we're learning, and so we will make mistakes, and we should apologize for mistakes when they're mistakes, but we shouldn't apologize for doing our jobs as journalists and trying to break stories. It's not like they were violating any privacy rights. This was a public event. This was in a public space. The journalists went to cover this public event. That should kind of be the end of the story, unless they wrote something that really, truly endangered the students, which I read the articles, and it didn't read to me like that. They shouldn't have to apologize for talking to students and calling them up.
So in our last minute, Mike, I think that pylon that Will in particular is talking about indicates that there's still this view sometimes of kids these days, when I think the reality is certain norms change. I think journalism probably should be protected. I think there are good opportunities to learn all the time. But my concern is my generation often wants to sort of just say kids these days instead of saying, we better pay attention here. A lot is changing.
Yeah, and I think it behooves us all to remember back when we were at that age. I mean, I remember as a cadet reporter, I learned a lot of things the hard way. Certain questions that I would ask and make people really just clam right up or burst into tears or, you know, obviously, well, you learn things the hard way. And I love the enthusiasm of young journalists, the one thing I do feel, you know, it's a good and a bad thing, right? No experience is good because you've got no preconceptions and you'll do things that older, staid-old journalists might not be willing to do. The bad thing is you have no sort of institutional memory, you know, so it's a struggle, right? You know,
I'm very fortunate. I look back in my career, no mistakes. So,
Oh, is your halo shining right now?
Fingers crossed, man. I want to thank our guests for being here. And I do think as long as there is journalism, it's in good hands. If it's in the hands of people like Will Lakin, Kayla Kaiser, Casey Matthews, here's hoping that there are models out there to allow you to continue to do the work. Thanks for the work you're doing. I appreciate your time and your perspective.
Thank you for having us here.
Mike Johansson, thank you very much. As always, great to have you. More Connections coming up.